Welcome, everybody. My name is Ray Choate. I'm the University Librarian here at the University of Adelaide at the Barr Smith Library, and it gives me great pleasure indeed to invite you here. I don't think we expected such a large crowd on an unseasonably warm day, so if some of you would like to shed jackets or jumpers, as I have, it's an opportunity to do that while everybody else is turning off their mobile phones, please. Okay, firstly, I would like to acknowledge the Kaurna people, the original custodians of the Adelaide Plains and the land on which the University of Adelaide's campuses at North Terrace, Waite, Theberton, and Roseworthy are built. Now I'd like to introduce the former president of the Friends of the Library, who will then introduce our speaker, Oliver Mayo.
Thanks very much, Ray. Well, it is a genuinely great pleasure to introduce our speaker, David Hunt, who you can see standing there. On the back of his book, he's a two-fisted drinker. On the back of his book, it says that he's an unusually tall and handsome man who likes writing his own biographical notes for all the books he has written, which is this one. He has worked as an historical consultant and comedy writer for television and has a proper job. Now, I looked on the web to find out about David, and it just illustrates how unreliable the web is. He was born in Paddington Women's Hospital, weighing over 5 kilos, and he's become unusually tall and handsome since then. And that, I think, is the only reliable statement in the 10 answers he's given. But I do know that he has an uncle in the foothills of Adelaide. And I'm not giving anything away by saying this, because I too have an uncle in the foothills of Adelaide, and indeed am an uncle in the foothills of Adelaide.
No relation.
Yes, quite so, quite so. This book, Gert. Well, you'd have to buy a book with that title, and it gets better. It is a truly wonderful book. And David is a person who loves the bookiness of books, and he recommends the Index to you. And I have used the Index, and I've found that the Index is not infallible. For example, because it didn't exist, South Australia is not mentioned in the Index. But it is actually mentioned in the book on page 11, where David explains to his own satisfaction why he's taller than I am. And there's also a person called Bodice Jack, who's not in the Index, but I can tell you this person is definitely in the book on page 162. This book is $29.99 if you can find a pre-Keating bookshop, or you buy 3 copies or more. But I got it for only $30, and it's an absolute steal. David Hunt is a very serious man who has written a very serious book about early Australian history and prehistory, which happens also to be screamingly funny. And so, without more ado, I ask David to come and tell us whatever he wants to for 35 minutes.
Thank you. Everybody else gets the wonderful microphones, but I get to feel like Madonna, which makes me very happy. This is the first time I've ever given a talk where it started with somebody inviting people to take their clothes off. And I'm very happy to be here in the bohemian city of Adelaide. I also would like to pay my respect to the traditional owners and custodians of this land. And when Ray first thanked them in his beautiful North American accent, I thought the traditional owners were the Downer people. Anyway, for those of you who wish to know why South Australians are shorter than other Australians, which was alluded to. It's fascinating that Gulliver's Travels was based or inspired by William Dampier's diary of his voyage around the world, and Jonathan Swift placed Lilliput sort of northwest of Van Diemen's Land, sort of right bang where Adelaide would be on a modern map. So that was that reference. Look, the first question that I'm asked is, why Gert? And it seems such an archaic word now, but in the 19th century, it was commonly used, and it was commonly used in connection with this wide brown land in which we live. And the reason was that the sea was considered to be a defining, or the fact that Australia was surrounded by sea was seen to be its defining characteristic. And when Australia was searching for nationhood, people invoked the fact that this continent was surrounded by water and was separate from the rest of the world and therefore deserved its own special place in it. So Sir Henry Parkes, who was the father of federation and was a poet of outstanding mediocrity, wrote, "God girdled our majestic isle with seas far-reaching east and west, that man might live beneath this smile in peace and freedom ever blessed." He was a better prime minister than poet. But Deakin, in support of federation, in his great federation speech, wrote, "For God has made her one, complete she lies, within the unbroken circle of the skies, and round her indivisible the sea breaks on her single shore." And Deakin wasn't going to let Tasmania get in the way of a good speech. But you can see from those two speeches how this notion of isolation from the rest of the world, this notion of separation, was instrumental in forming Australian national identity. So whilst Geoffrey Blainey is obsessed by the tyranny of distance, I focus on the despotism of lots of water. Because Australia is... The sea has defined Australia. It kept the Aborigines blissfully unaware of the benefits of Western civilization for tens of millennia. The convicts were parked here because Britain desperately needed somewhere to park all of its pickpockets, rapists and Irishmen, and they couldn't walk back to Britain. So the idea of basically putting them at the arse end of the world on an island nation was terribly appealing to the Brits. Today, if you have a look at the White Australia policy, for example, this notion that Australia is insular, separated from the world, informed our attitude to many foreign people for decades. And still today, the key political touchstone debate around boat people. If we were not good by sea, we would not have boat people, just unwanted pedestrians. So you can see today that still this notion of we are separate from the rest of the world, there is a barrier between us and them, still exists. So that's the academic reason for the title of my book. The real reason is it's a ludicrous word that everybody has a laugh at, and it sums up the ridiculousness of some of our history. I love Australian history. I absolutely love it. But I don't like the way that it's often communicated. As a schoolboy, it was about sheep, criminals, more sheep. There were some dotted lines on a map. There was a guy called Captain Cook, and then I fell asleep. I do remember being dragged out in the rain in year five to visit the Captain Cook Monument at Botany Bay. And geez, it was boring, it was wet, it was miserable. There's an obelisk. This is where he landed. Okay, can I have recess now? I think was my sort of attitude. And that's incredibly regrettable that many Australian children today feel exactly the same way about our history. Many Australian adults feel the same way as well. And the Captain Cook Monument, there's a salutary story in this. The Captain Cook Monument honours Captain Cook, and it was built on the centenary of Cook's landing in 1870. And it honours him for landing at Botany Bay on the 28th of April in 1770, even though he didn't arrive until the following afternoon. So for 145 years, this pretty basic error has remained uncorrected. And it says something about our she'll be right, half-assed approach to our own history, that we are prepared to let that sort of thing slide. Can you imagine the Americans, you know, the Mayflower rocks up. Nah, they wouldn't be doing that, but we do. And that's interesting. And it does say something about our relationship with our history and the way that it is taught, because much of Australian history is now taught, it's thematically taught. It's about society and societal movements. So historians are happy to talk about imperialism and transportation, land management, you know, democratic institutions, class conflict, and the way that Aboriginal people have been treated. But it is a very thematic approach, and something is lost in that. And what's lost is people and personalities. And so what I've tried to do is write a book which explains those themes, but focusing on people and their quirks and their personalities, because people find people interesting. We're all people. Horrible Histories, which is a great show for kids and a great show for adults, has hit on this as a formula for making history interesting and engaging. It's telling real stories about real people. And I think that's a very effective way that we can broaden an interest in our past, because at the moment it's pretty niche. People here are probably interested in history. I'm interested in history, but many people aren't. And I think that historians can communicate perhaps more effectively. One of the other things we do in our history is we reduce many of our great characters to archetypes. Captain Cook is a great explorer. Matthew Flinders is a great navigator. Bennelong is a man trapped between two cultures. Lachlan Macquarie is a nation builder. And William Bligh, well, everybody knows he was a complete bastard. And there's no... whichever way you look at William Bligh, that's what he was. And I think we do this more than other nations. And I've been struggling to come to terms with why is it that we feel the need to, instead of looking at people in all of their glorious complexity, reduce them to these archetypes. And I think it's perhaps because we're still slightly embarrassed that we don't have a proper history. And there's this notion that many people have that to have a proper history, you've got to have great battles and the fall of, rise and fall of empires. You know, statues of inbred monarchs and great castles. And that's not true. This notion of the cultural cringe, I think, still infects the way that we feel about our history. And there's a story I tell in the book of Hamilton Hume, who was an explorer who didn't get on well with Mr. Hovell. But when he was just starting out in the explorer game, he went and saw Governor Macquarie and said, "I'd really like to get out and do a bit of exploring, although I am an Australian." He basically thought that the people who should be going and doing exploring were people who'd been born in Britain rather than the native-born, that they should come out and discover things, and he was just a native-born Australian. And I think we've still perhaps feel a little bit that way about our past. So let's have a look at a couple of our archetypes. Governor Macquarie is traditionally reduced to the guy who built things and named lots of things after himself. He was nice to convicts, and he was the benign father of Australian democracy. That's the Macquarie that we all know. Macquarie was a much more complex character. He actually wrote of his implacable hatred of the infernal and destructive principles of democracy, which he believed to be decadently Greek, unfashionably French, and dangerously American. He wasn't a Democrat. He hated democracy. There'd been all these revolutions throughout the world kicking the British out of places, and the French, and, you know, challenging the monarchy. He wasn't a Democrat. He'd be horrified that he is now held up as this sort of paragon of democratic ideals. He was very tolerant of emancipated convicts, but he wasn't the convict's friend. He actually more strictly regimented convict life than any governor in the past. Convicts in the past had been able to wander around the fields, hoeing for a couple of hours a day, then going and tending their own veggie patches. Macquarie locked them all up in institutions and made them wear funny uniforms. So he wasn't the way that he is often depicted. And the things that we aren't taught about, and that perhaps we should, you know, he suffered terribly from syphilis and the mercury that he had to dip his affected region into on a regular basis. The great line of the sort of Georgian days, a night with Venus and a lifetime with Mercury. And it gave him, it basically meant all of his teeth sort of started to fall out. He had an interesting neurological twitch. His skin was yellow. All the paintings you see of him, he's wearing a lot of makeup. He wasn't a good-looking bloke. He was also a raging alcoholic. And if you actually read his diaries, which they're very entertaining diaries, basically he talks about how many drinks he has on a regular basis. And when he was marrying his first wife, he determined to impress her with his discipline. And he defined discipline as getting dressed by 2:30 in the afternoon, drinking no more than 12 glasses of wine and one strong beer a night, and only consuming malt liquor during daylight hours. Now, that was his idea of restraint. This was whilst he was in India, and after a really big bender, he writes in his diary, in quite a shaky hand, no beer for 3 months. Macquarie was a great warrior, and the Scots who got their asses completely kicked in the Battle of Culloden, after that, basically spent a lot of time trying to prove to the British how good they were at fighting. And because the British had stripped them of their lands and entitlements, the only way that a Scot could get ahead was to join the army, go overseas, kill people and steal from them. And Macquarie was very keen on basically, you know, moving into people's towns and stealing their goods. He also has a proud history of fraud. When he married his first wife, who was much wealthier than he was, her family basically said, look, you're not to touch her money. And he said, no, I wouldn't be doing that. And of course, several months into the marriage, when she was spending hand over fist and he was feeling in financial straits, he was caught trying to, you know, dip into her trust account, much to the disgust of his in-laws. He also invested soldiers' way. He was the army paymaster in India, the regimental paymaster. He took soldiers' wages, invested them for his own benefit, creamed the interest off the top before paying the soldiers, and was particularly proud in his diaries of his tax evasion, as all Scotsmen are. He claimed that £3,000 worth of shares were his brother's, and the tax man came and found basically £1,000 lying around in a sock drawer back on the Isle of Mull, which Macquarie claimed belonged to an unusually wealthy servant. It's actually interesting, and I'm going to talk about stereotypes a little bit later, but the term to get off scot-free. Scot-free is a term for evading tax. The scot was a tax introduced in the 15th century, and to get off scot-free was to avoid paying tax. And he was proud of his ability to avoid the inland revenue. His greatest frauds were what he did in terms of securing military commissions and fake military commissions for his relatives. So he had a 96-year-old uncle who he insisted be made an officer of the Horse Guard. But even more entertainingly, he got 5- and 6-year-old cousins to change their name and had them enlisted as officers in the British Army. And the grand old, the Duke of York, of grand old Duke of York fame, found out about this and basically said to Macquarie, what are you doing? Produce these two new officers so I can see them. And he said, oh, they've just got on a boat to Jamaica. I'm sorry, I can't show them to you. And the Duke of York, who'd been doing a bit of research, basically said, no, look, I know they're at the local primary school just down the road. So the grand old Duke of York had 10,000 men and 2 small Scottish boys. And for that, Lachlan was again banished to India. So he was a complex man. And you can see in those stories there, I focus, I suppose, on 3 things. Love of alcohol, love of violence, and being interested in doing things with money. Now, those are the three sort of ultimate Scottish stereotypes that we use today. I think I describe the sporran in my book as a small pouch in which Scotsmen hide their hip flasks, knuckle dusters, and any small denomination coins they've not yet had the opportunity to bury in their backyards. And it's interesting how these stereotypes of Scotsmen existed in that day. And people were always talking about, you know, you couldn't trust a Scotsman with money. M.H. Ellis has written the definitive biography of Macquarie in the 1940s and 50s, he wrote it. Again, focuses, he feels quite happy to make stereotypical snide comments about Scots, in particular what Macquarie did when he came to New South Wales. He introduced toll roads. He basically said, I'm not going to spend my government money on building roads. You're going to pay for them. So he introduced the first toll roads. He successfully basically spent a couple of £1,000s on getting a £40,000 hospital built, the Rum Hospital, through giving people access to a monopoly on the rum trade. And in his most prudent bit of Scottish financial management, he introduced our first official currency, the Holy Dollar. He bought Spanish dollars in, cut the middle out of the coin, which was called the dump, said the original coin was worth a dollar, the dump was worth a quarter of a dollar, and hey presto, you know, he'd suddenly expanded the colonial treasury by a quarter. And so M.H. Ellis feels quite free in talking about these as sort of the typical niggardly money management approaches of the Scots. And I do find that stereotyping interesting, and you'll see in the book, I hope you understand the irony that I engage in a little bit of that myself. Captain Cook, the great explorer. It's really interesting, we all focus on Cook. I was told at school that he discovered Australia, which is an insult to the Aborigines, the Dutch, the Macassans, possibly the Portuguese, if you accept that theory. Cook quite clearly knew where he was going after circumnavigating New Zealand. He says in his diary, he's off to the eastern coast of New Holland. So he knew it was there. He didn't discover it. But we have this myth, this myth that Captain Cook was the great man who allowed Australia to be Australia. And what's fascinating is that the bloke who was far more important on that expedition was Joseph Banks, who's become a footnote in Australian history. Just as an aside, because I like the story, Captain James Cook was the inspiration for Captain James Kirk of Star Trek fame. So Gene Roddenberry, the guy who invented Star Trek, was an absolute Captain Cook nut and based Star Trek on the voyages of Captain Cook. So Captain James Cook is based on Captain James Kirk. The Enterprise and Endeavour have similar meanings. Joseph Banks was actually the inspiration for Dr. Spock as the... or Mr. Spock. I think that's just a nice little side. But so probably the Americans knew more about Banks through Star Trek than we did. He didn't even get on an Australian stamp until 1970. He wasn't even the first botanist to get on an Australian stamp, that honour going to Sir Ferdinand Jacob Heinrich von Müller, who discovered the macadamia nut. And that's sad because Joseph Banks was perhaps the most critical figure in our history for the first several decades of Australian discovery and settlement. He was the first person to recommend convict settlement in New South Wales. He was the principal advisor to George III in the British Parliament on all things New South Welshian. He was the father of the merino industry. A little known fact is that he actually spent time kidnapping Spanish sheep to build the British wool trade. He didn't do it personally, but he sent people off to hang around the Spanish coastline, look for a vaguely Spanish-looking sheep and stuff it in a bag. He instructed Flinders to circumnavigate what he assumed was the continent, but it hadn't been proven at that stage. to prove that New Holland and New South Wales were part of the same joint. Of course, he got Governor Bligh both into breadfruit and governorship. So he had an incredible influence on our early history and was originally known as the father of Australia before Lachlan Macquarie took over that title. But what isn't so known now about Banks, but was how he was perceived at the age, was that he was a notorious swinger and pants man. Absolutely notorious. When he left on the Endeavour voyage, he left his 17-year-old girlfriend at home. He was feeling a bit dodgy about the whole relationship and was quite happy to get on the boat. And when he got back and was famous and everybody was fading him, and they did fade him. Captain Cook was just the guy who steered the boat. He wasn't big on the tea and cucumber sandwiches circuit. Banks was. Banks paid this girl £5,000 to quietly go away. And there's a wonderful scandal sheet of the age called the Town and Country magazine that says of Joseph Banks, "The women of most countries he has visited have undergone every critical inspection by him." His own diary talks about an interesting three-way encounter with two Tahitian women in a tent. He was famous for going out on fishing expeditions with Lord Sandwich, who was the head of the Admiralty and one of the founding fathers of the Hellfire Club, which was a very bohemian club, the sort of club where you invite people to take off all their clothes at the beginning of the evening. And David Hume, the great English philosopher, wrote of these fishing trips how Sandwich and Banks would pack two or three ladies of pleasure with their fishing tackle and their other tackle. And if you read his diary, he passes comments on it. He loves the women of Cape Town. He thinks they have excellent childbearing hips and would make excellent, excellent wives. He had this reputation. When he got back to Britain, he took on another young lady whose father was struggling under crippling gambling debts, had his only child with her. He kept her in a house somewhere separate in London. He embarked on a passionate affair with his much older housekeeper. And the great story that Cook tells of Banks's philandering ways is that Banks was the architect and was meant to be on Cook's second voyage, but it got a bit too big for his boots. And he insisted that the entire ship be reconverted to give him more cabin room and more headspace. And he used to throw parties where Banks groupies would gather on the ship and tell Banks how great he was. And he was off to again try and find Terra Australis Incognita. And Cook thought this was a waste of time. It had already conclusively proven in his own mind that it didn't exist, but Banks wanted to go sailing again. So they outfit this ship. And then it won't sail. It's all too top heavy with all of the party space that Banks has had, so they have to saw it all down again. And Banks is so pissed off that he says, "Right, I'm not going." You know, Huff takes off his bags and Cook gets sent off. And in the island of Madeira, a man comes and says, "I'd like to join the crew. I'm Mr. Banks's companion." She said, "Oh, sorry, you know, Mr. Banks isn't here." And the man was very, very distressed. This man introduced himself as Mr. Burnett, and Cook said every aspect of Mr. Burnett's appearance tended to prove that he was a woman. So Banks had adopted a great tradition of French naturalists and explorers of attempting to disguise his mistress at the time as a boy to take her on a long sea voyage. Classy guy. And why is it? I mean, if we knew some more of these stories about our own history, if I'd known, perhaps at school I wouldn't have been told about the Tahitian three-way. Fair enough. But apart from that, I think if I'd known some of these other facts, I would have found our history a little more interesting. Now, we have a unique history. We are a nation that sprang from a colony of criminals, with a 90% to 10% male-to-female ratio, thousands of miles from civilization, with a monetary policy that involved having no money, quite deliberately. It was part of the government's plans that there would be no treasury, it would all be done on barter, where rum was the liquid currency of choice. This is a unique set of social circumstances, and it creates great stories and great history. Here's a quote. "Australian history is almost always picturesque. Indeed, it is so curious and strange that it is itself the chiefest novelty the country has to offer, and so pushes the other novelties into second and third place. It does not read like history, but like the most beautiful lies, and all of a fresh new sort, no mouldy old stale ones. It is full of surprises and adventures and incongruities and contradictions and incredibilities, but they are all true. They all happened." That was actually written by Mark Twain of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn fame, when Mark was down on his luck. He did what Bill Bryson does now and goes on a world literary tour in order to get some more money. And so he came to Australia and he wrote that. And it's sad. I think this is probably the greatest thing that has been said about how interesting our history is. And it was written by an American, which is, you know, one of the saddest things about cultural imperialism that I've come across. There are a number of stories that made me want to write this book. The mooning of Lieutenant Governor Franklin and his wife, Lady Jane, which is debated as to whether this is a true story or not, because it's only recounted in one source document. But the story goes down in Tasmania at the female factory, the Cascades female factory. The women of the factory were being inspected by the Lieutenant Governor Franklin, and they were unhappy with conditions there, and their form of political protest was not to wear any underpants. And when the Lieutenant Governor got up on stage, 300 women turned around and mooned him. and the eyewitness account says they turned around and shooed their naked posteriors, slapping them rhythmically and making an most unmusical noise. And I thought, if somebody had told me at school about the first mass brown eyeing in Australian history, I would have been rapt. Now this is one of the greatest and perhaps little known stories, I think, of our history. You all know about Matthew Flinders, the great navigator, the navigator par excellence. He was an incredible man. He circumnavigated Australia. He named Australia. He was the first person to propose that this continent be called Australia. There are more statues of Matthew Flinders in Australia than of any other man, and there are more statues of his cat Trim than of any other cat. So he holds an important place in our history. He used to go on little weekend sailing cruises down the south coast in a very small boat with his good buddy George Bass. Bass and Flinders were something of a double act, thick as thieves. In 1998, a letter was discovered from Flinders to Bass, written in 1800. It's in the State Library of New South Wales. And it's a long letter, but this is an extract from it. "There was a time when I was so completely wrapped up in you that no conversation but yours could give me any degree of pleasure. Your footsteps on the quarterdeck over my head took me from my book and brought me upon deck to walk with you. And yet it is not clear to me that I love you entirely. At least my affection for Wiles reaches farther into my heart. I would take him into the same skin as me." It's a beautiful letter with beautiful sentiment. But it does, to many minds today, suggest that they may have been more than just good sailing buddies. Yes, that he puffed with a southerly wind in nautical jargon. This letter was opened and read by the new Mrs. Bass whilst George Bass was busy sailing off the coast of South America and drowning there. And Mrs. Bass scrawls an alarm note to her husband on the envelope, which is also in the State Library. "This, George, is written by a man that bears a bad character. No one has seen this letter, but I could tell you many things that make me dislike him." So how is it that we live in this age? We have two of our greatest national heroes, and, you know, this sort of thing is not more widely known. And I was absolutely stunned when I came across this in reading one of sort of Tim Flannery's. It wasn't dwelt upon in any great length, it was just there. You know, some people say this was the romantic love of the era, like Shakespeare and His Fair Youth, or like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. But there's certainly something there that suggests an intimacy. And in this day and age, it was not easy to be a gay Georgian. Lord Castlereagh, who was the Secretary of State for the Colonies and the man who sent Macquarie out here as governor, had his own difficulties with being a gay Georgian. He was the most powerful man. He was the leader of the Tories in the House of Commons at the time. He went and saw King George the Fourth in 1822 and said to the king, "I have been accused of the same crime as the Bishop of Cloger. The Bishop of Cloger had been found pants down with a Grenadier Guardsman in a Westminster pub. And George the Fourth said, "Don't worry, dear man, go and consult a physician." Castlereagh didn't do that. He went back to his estate and slit his own throat with a letter opener because he was being blackmailed for homosexual acts. His carriage was pelted with cobblestones, the funeral carriage. People came and threw excrement and dead cats and cobblestones. And Lord Byron penned the following touching obituary: "Posterity will never survey a nobler grave than this. Here lie the bones of Castlereagh. Stop, traveller, and piss." So the suggestion that Bass and Flinders, if they, and let's face it, people in the Royal Navy spent a lot of time with other blokes, you know, some historians say, well, they never said they were gay, therefore they weren't. It was not a good era in which a sailor could come out of Davy Jones' locker. Interestingly, the other, the leader of the Whigs, Henry Grey Bennett, in Parliament at the time, who was the sponsor of the Big Report. How am I going for time, by the way? 10 minutes? 7 minutes. The sponsor of the Big Report, which was designed to get rid of Macquarie, who was Castlereagh's protege, was himself found in a compromising position with a young male worker in a Belgian health spa. And he too was outed. His Lady Bennett was far more understanding, and the two of them went and lived out an obscure life together in Lake Como. But he was forced also to leave Britain. So some of these stories, I think, illustrate difficulties or challenges of living in different ages. And you can understand about the society by looking at these real stories about real people. Getting back to this notion of archetypes and stereotypes, we've always had in Australia, apart from South Australia, I would say, which is the most liberal, has a history of being the most sort of liberal and tolerant part of Australia, but there has always been a degree of racism and racial stereotyping. And we have this notion today that we're an egalitarian society, where our history has always been one of encouraging, you know, the fair go and everybody being equal. You know, the Aborigines, the Chinese, and the various other Asian people who suffered through much of the 19th century would probably disagree with that assessment. But the group that was persecuted most of all were the Irish. And let's face it, it's great to make fun of an Irishman. And they do it themselves. Governor Hunter described the Irish in Australia as extremely insolent, refractory and turbulent. Governor King called them satanic. And Samuel Marsden opined, "The low Irish convicts are an extraordinary race of beings whose minds are depraved beyond all conception and their whole thoughts employed on mischief." There was this notion that the Irish were sectarian rebels who basically wanted to come over here and, you know, drink and fight and basically spread Catholicism and sectarianism in the colony. It was a fair call, actually. But
So if you have a look at, this is my favourite, I think, quote I've come across in my studies. It's from the Melbourne Argus in 1850. And it talks about, as a result of the Irish potato famine, there was a mass immigration of young Irish girls who came out to Australia to serve as domestic help, basically. And the Melbourne Argus described these new Irish domestic servants as useless trollops with squat, stunted figures, thick waists and clumsy ankles, a set of ignorant creatures whose whole knowledge of household duties barely reaches to distinguishing the inside from the outside of a potato, and whose chief employment hitherto has consisted of some such intellectual occupation as occasionally trotting across a bog to fetch back a runaway pig. This was the leading newspaper of the age. God, I wish I could write like that. But it's nasty and it's vicious. And it's also quite funny. But you have a look at the way that the Irish had were seen as different and the stereotypes about them. People have been making Irish jokes for over 700 years. They all involve the Irish being a bit dim. And that stereotype had some basis in truth, because the English spent a lot of time oppressing the Irish back in Ireland. They deliberately prevented Catholic priests from educating young Irish Catholics. And there's a wonderful document, which is a survey of the diet of Irish people in 1814. The poor of County Clare ate potato and salt and sour milk all year round. And I think the poor of County Cork didn't even get the sour milk. Now, if you have a diet that consists of nothing but potato, you do develop a squat figure, you have rickets in the legs, and your brain has been not allowed to grow as it would in a healthy diet. So there was this notion that the Irish were dim-witted plodders. And that stereotype did have some basis in truth, but it had nothing to do with race or ethnicity. It had to do with persecution and diet. If you were an Irishman, you could be transported for the crime of homelessness, which was not a crime in Britain. You could actually also be transported for the simple crime of being Irish. There are some people who were put on the boats who didn't have a criminal record. Basically, they just rounded up a person with an O and an apostrophe at the beginning of their name and packed them off to Australia. the Irish convicts weren't originally sent to Australia. They were sent to another place called Sydney in Canada until I think the early 1790s. So you can imagine all of these Irish people saying, oh, it's so warm down in Australia. We're off for a touch of the sun. Yes, let's pack for Sydney. And then they get loaded onto these boats and find themselves freezing off the coast of Nova Scotia. So they were dudded even then, and a third of them died. A third of these Irish who were shipped off to Canada died on the way, whilst only 2% of the convicts on the First Fleet died. There's a couple of great Irish stories. In 1792, the first Irish ship that came out, the Queen, 21 convicts, and this was reported in diaries of many of the early colonists who referred to them as China travellers, because the Irish, not having benefited from great educations, believed that China was about 100 miles to the north of Sydney, and they basically decided to escape and walk there. So they set off, and one of them has a bit of paper with an arrow drawn on it, which is his compass. So the guy with the bit of paper with the arrow walks. He runs into an obstacle, turns around, and sets off. Oh, we'll go this way then. So this story, they managed to escape an impressive 26 miles. Four of them died. Yep. And the final Irish story, which I do love, this disturbed the British establishment so much that the next time the Irish planned a mass breakout, they then decided that there was a white colony 300 miles, a secret white colony 300 miles to the southwest of Sydney, and they were going to escape en masse. This time the governor became aware of their plans and said, look, I really don't want you to get hurt this time, and he gave them an armed escort, the only state-sponsored prison breakout in Australian history. So look, my message for you tonight is Australian history is fascinating, it's exciting. We should embrace our history, warts and all, or in Macquarie's case, syphilitic lesions and all. And what we should do is we should tell stories, and we should tell stories about real people, because I think if we focus on the people, the thematic stuff comes along with that. If we are able to engage and connect with people about our history, I think that's a good way of communicating it. So enjoy your Australian history, and thank you.
Well, everyone's come along expecting to be entertained and informed and indeed to some extent enlightened, and they have been. And David is very happy to take a few questions.
I am.
I'm an international student from Florida.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be the only Australian history book that I will read during my time here. I know the joke has been lost on me, but the man in the water who's got the
seagull on his head.
Seagull, and I just noticed he's got seagull poop on his shoulder too.
He does have seagull poop.
Please tell me who that man is.
That's Arthur Phillip, the first governor of New South Wales, the man who had a particularly enlightened policy on homosexuality. He proposed that anybody in his new colony convicted of the crime of buggery would be transported to New Zealand and fed to the Maori. So that was our first official policy in that area.
Is there anyone writing this sort of history about pre-white history, Indigenous history in Australia?
Look, it's tough, and I do have a chapter called The Unoriginal Non-Inhabitants, which is this notion of who are these people who suddenly, when we had the Mabo decision, miraculously appear in 1992. But I do look at Aboriginal prehistory. It's a difficult... Aboriginal history is difficult to address in the satirical tone that I employ, but I've treated them in the same way that I would anybody else. So there's some Aboriginal prehistory in there, and also a fair bit of stuff around Bennelong, Pemulwuy, and some of the other Bungaree and some of the earlier Aboriginal figures. So there's some in there, but no, I don't think anybody else has done that.
A bit of a two-part question.
I wrote the first one down.
Is the dreadful stuff we were fed as kids in the 50s, 60s, 70s a result of 19th century bolderisation of, taking all the good bits out? And do we have a hope for the future? I don't know how much you know about history at Adelaide, but... I can say that the way it's taught here to young undergraduates is it's back to the sources every time.
Yep.
None of this reading the secondary nonsense. They do look at that.
Sure.
And I think finding these primary sources is what brings it all alive again, as you're demonstrating.
Look, our history has been constantly reinvented. So for a long period of time, there was no greater shame than carrying the convict stain. Families would create whole new stories about their origins because they were ashamed of having a convict. Now you want at least three or four for a bit of street cred. So I think attitudes have changed. There's a great essay on how Aboriginal history has been taught since the 1950s by John Hirst. And I think we're moving perhaps in the opposite direction, because you had a sort of anthropological approach taken in the 1950s that took the good with the bad. And this essay shows that it's the same edition of a textbook that is looked at every time there's a new edition, and anything that is negative or perceived as negative about Aboriginal people is taken out bit by bit over a period of 35 years. So I think we're constantly reinventing our history and sometimes hiding or burying inconvenient truths because of the prism through which we view our past today.
The issue of cultural cringe you discussed, I see that's a very significant issue for Australia. Beyond word of mouth and publishing books like yours, what else do you think can be done to fix this thing? Is there any kind of agitation?
I'll just go. Look, I actually don't think the cultural cringe we have today is nearly as bad. I think we are now a fairly forward-looking, independent people. I no longer think we, suckle at the vinegared teat of Mother Britain or dangle at the coattails of Uncle Sam. I mean, we do it a bit, but I think we do have a sense of our own identity now in the arts and in other areas. I think there are legacy hangovers of the cultural cringe that are still with us. I suspect over time, I hope over time, they will fade away as we become more confident of ourselves as a people, and I think we're well on that route already.
I would love to let the questioning go on because the answers will be even more revelatory. But looking at the time, we do have to call a halt and thank David very much for a superb talk, a wonderful book, and a splendid evening. And thank you very much.